Hello, welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I'm an actor, writer, and comedian. And if you'd like to support the show, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/requiredreading. Our guest today is Olive Lorraine. They are a writer and actor that you may have seen in Neon's How to Blow Up a Pipeline and whose writing can be seen on Apple TV's The Big Door Prize. Hello.
Hello.
What are you reading these days?
What am I reading these days? Well, pr presently, I've kind of been combing through a collection of Mary Oliver's poems, poetry, in the it's in the collection Devotions, which is like kind of a collection of like a lot of like several different books of hers. And it's amazing. I have like read poems from Mary Oliver throughout my life. Like she's, so prolific. So it's like having it all, or not all, but a lot of it in one place that kind of spans her entire career is really awesome. And I love it. And I'm trying to start Sally Rooney's new book. But, it's hard.
Yeah, both of those things together, you've really set up a
I'm
difficult.
like, how much yearning can I put up with right now?
Plus, with
Especially
this
with,
book on top of
yeah, I'm
it,
like,
yeah.
okay, I'm rereading Wuthering Heights, reading Mary Oliver, and now we have new Sally Rooney. I don't know if I can, I don't know if I could cope
That's a lot.
that with that much dark yearning.
Yeah, I forget what I just finished because I just finished a book the other day, other than stuff for this podcast, but I just started reading I have like a the portable Edgar Allan Poe because I've never read really any of his stuff. And tomorrow is Halloween. And he is from Baltimore and I'm from the other side of Maryland. I love that the football team is named after a poem. And I think like that's really fantastic. I think that's
That
great.
is so queer. They don't even know it.
No. I've only recently become a sports person, so it's still kind of new, but I love that. I love
Yeah.
that.
What kind of sports are you watching?
It started with basketball,
Yeah.
because my dad went to University of Kentucky, which is
Yeah.
very big
Wow, did
basketball
he
place.
play there or was he just a
No.
what?
No.
Oh, I
No,
was
no.
like,
He just went there.
damn.
No. There's my whole family is like decidedly not athletes. Like I have like a second cousin who's like a gymnast and in football, and we're all like, I don't know how Zeke got that way. We're very proud of him, but it's very confusing.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was in middle school just like doing so many flips, and we're like, that.
You're like, there goes Zeke.
But I moved to LA this season that the Lakers won the national championship. So I was like perfectly primed. And then my boyfriend went to USC, not as an athlete, but really loves their football team. So then I got into football. And now the Dodgers are in the World Series. So I'm getting a little into baseball.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fun. It's like, I went to a USC game a couple of weeks ago and it's like I understand it. I
Yeah,
understand the
for sure.
appeal of like going somewhere to scream. Yeah.
Yeah,
100%.
it is a mass communal somatic exercise. We're all
Yes.
screaming and cheering together, and no one can judge us, and we can look as crazy as we want. And there is
Really,
something
truly.
liberating about that. The main sport that I will watch is basketball, so that's why up when you said your dad went to University of Kentucky, because yeah, their team is amazing, or historically amazing. I actually don't know how they're doing right now, but yeah, love basketball.
Do
And
you like the
Lakers,
Lakers?
I actually, so like I was a Spurs fan for a long time because of Texas. Should be a Rockets fan, because I'm from Houston, but Spurs, yeah, their team is just, or historically has been amazing. But when I moved to LA and started dating someone who was from the Bay, I very quickly became a Golden State Warriors fan, but it was mostly just because I loved the players and the coach. I mean, I guess that's why you like a basketball team, but yeah, I just loved Golden State Warriors and I didn't really care if people called me a bandwagoner, but yeah, they're just such a good quality team and pretty devastated that Klay Thompson is no longer part of that dynamic trio. But yeah, enough about sports.
Well, what a transition. Our book today is Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte from 1847. I want to put a little like second of Kate Bush's Wuthering Heights right here. And that's good. That's enough.
Yep.
We'll put that in and post. We just said silently.
Love her.
So I had never read Wuthering Heights before. It is Emily Bronte's only novel. The Bronte siblings, first off, like, just fascinating. I haven't read any other Bronte work, but there were six siblings. Four lived to adulthood. Emily was the second youngest. Anne was the only one younger. She died at 30. Her book was published the year before she died, 1847, which I think all of the Bronte women had their like first novel published that year, which is weird.
Wow.
So I was showing Olive earlier, my copy is very neat that I found in a little free library. It has the dirtiest portrait of Emily Bronte in it. But in this, she, like Olive said, she looks like she smelled the worst fart in the world.
So true. And she looks so upset and disgusted.
People say some people have like a pointed face and it's really all to one point. But yeah. There's one little anecdote in here that I loved, which was the legends which survive of her reveal the extraordinary moral and physical toughness of this frail and ailing girl. On one occasion, for example, having been bitten by a dog, which I bring up because I was recently bitten by a dog, having been bitten by a dog with rabies, she calmly heated an iron and cauterized the bites herself.
Badass, dude. I love her.
Only weeks later did the story come out when Charlotte noticed the ugly scars. Fantastic.
Somebody needs to write a comedy about the Bronte sisters, actually.
They're just bizonkers. And I was doing like a tiny bit of research on the Bronte siblings, not a ton, but it seemed like throughout their life, the sisters would like go to school or like go to become a teacher and would venture out, and then Emily would be like, no, dog, I have to go home. I simply will not be here anymore. I don't like this. Mm-hmm. Which I love.
Yeah, I love that.
And then a little bit about 1847. She was living in England, but Samuel Colt sells his first revolver to the U.S. government. The Donner Party dies. The first known publication of the classic joke, Why Did the Chicken Cross the Road, appears in the Knickerbocker magazine.
Wow. Iconic year.
Huge. I mean, huge year for comedy. Let's all write it down. Huge year for chickens. Huge year for the U.S. issuing its first postage stamps.
Okay.
And invading Mexico.
Oh.
Michigan abolished the death penalty. And in England, the world's first municipally funded civic public park opens.
Okay. I'm thinking about the Michigan death penalty thing because did they ever reinstate it? Because, like, if not, they were way ahead of the game. Because Texas just got rid of that, like, three. Did they? They got rid of it.
The quick little Google answer says maybe there's only been one execution carried out in Michigan, which was a guy in 1938.
Midwesterners just too nice. You don't have to kill them.
Yeah, we just have to turn his bones into pistons. I don't know. Right. I don't know anything about cars. I had never read this book before. I loved reading it in October. Mm-hmm. Again, tomorrow is Halloween. Tell me, how did this book come into your life? What's your story with it?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm glad that you've enjoyed it because it did feel like an appropriate October choice. Because one, it's spooky for Halloween. And two, it's romantic for Libra season. So it just felt like, and then it bleeds into Scorpio, which like tons of that energy in this book. Sorry, this is not an astrology book podcast, but this episode might be strong.
Maybe it should be. Yeah. Go for it.
Anyway, I was assigned this book, I think my sophomore year of high school. And it was like one of the first books that I was actually excited about to read. Because we were assigned so few female authors when I was in school. I mean, I went to school in Texas, so that just wasn't like prioritized. But, you know, it just so happened to my two favorite books from high school were female authors. The other one I was debating choosing was Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. Yeah, but I was like, that's not really an October vibe. That's more of like a June, July vibe. But I read this when I was a sophomore and again was just excited to like read female author. And then at the same time, like it was the first like romance novel that we would ever read in school or that I ever read in school. And so I was also very excited about that. And like, it seemed kind of creepy. And like, I had read, you know, Twilight in middle school. And so I was like, I feel like this is going to be the same kind of energy as Twilight.
Isn't Bella always reading this? Do I remember that correctly?
Oh my God, is she?
Let's look.
Yeah, let's look it up. What book is Bella reading? Oh my God, this would make so much sense.
In Eclipse.
Pride and Prejudice.
Ah.
Oh wait, Edward Cullen references books like Romeo and Juliet and Wuthering Heights. That's so funny. Romeo and Juliet was another one of my options. But I was like, it's a play, so I don't know. But I'm not surprised that Edward Cullen would reference Wuthering Heights, because he is giving Heathcliff for sure.
You mentioned this a little bit before we started of like the level of obsession in the relationship here, like screams teenagehood to me, definitely.
Yeah, but it's adults. So yeah, I was telling Aaron earlier that like I was really curious as to what my response would be to rereading it, because I remember when I first read it as a teenager, I was like, oh, if I could just meet a boy that would be this obsessed with me and would say these like dark, consuming, like rapturous, romantic things to me. Like, and then like, you know, obviously every boy paled in comparison in high school. But then rereading it as an adult, I was like, oh, this makes sense as to like the kind of people that I've been drawn to. Because definitely had a pattern in relationships that have started very obsessive, intense, spiritual, like kind of like that. That's kind of what I still love about this book, is that like romance is a spiritual experience for them, and it's so close to the veil. Like there's a lot of like talk of like love and death and like what it means to die with and without love, and the idea of like dying to be with, you know, your eternal love, very Romeo and Juliet. Also, of course, I read that now and I'm like, that's toxic as hell, but like it's kind of like, you know, when you watch like Phantom Thread, you want the intensity of that passion without the level of maybe obsession or control that exists in the dynamic. Like, is it too much to ask to like want someone to theoretically want to die for me, but not actually die? Like, I wouldn't want someone to actually die for me, but like, yeah.
But the offer?
Yeah, it's the thought.
It's the thought that counts.
The thought that counts. Just tell me you were thinking about dying with me, alongside me. for our, and that our love transcends time and space. And that's kind of like another thing that goes off of like the spirituality and the closeness to the veil of the romance in Wuthering Heights, is like their love, it like is more expansive than the two of them. And you know, whether or not that's a reliable, you know, you could read the book and just be like, these two people are fucking crazy, like they need help, whatever. But like my magical thinking, my romantic brain is always like, yeah, love that is real and true knows no bounds, knows no time, knows no physical form. And like, that's why that there's like a passage in the book where Catherine's talking to Nellie and she's basically like, I am Heathcliff. Like one of the few times that she's like actually openly admitting her true feelings for him, because she fights it for a while. But well, she says that her love for Linton is like foliage, which is true, but ever changing and evolving with the seasons. But her love for Heathcliff is the rock beneath the foliage. It is unchanging. And you can't, she basically is like, I don't see where I end and he begins. There's this one quote she says, Heathcliff is more me than I am. And I
yes.
sobbed. I was like, oh my God. Like, I don't know if I'm just like sick in the head with like romance and stuff, but like, I fucking love that shit.
Yes, that scene was incredible. I highlighted it as well. It's somewhere in here. He's more myself than I am. Whatever our souls are made of, his and mine are the same.
So beautiful to me. Like, I mean, there's obviously one way to look at it, which is like the highly codependent, like, you complete me, I can't exist without you. And there's definitely that tone. But like, if you zoom out and you actually try to understand what it is like that these characters are feeling, and more importantly, like what Emily Bronte obviously has felt at some point in her life, or maybe wishes to feel, it's that this like love, like true love, makes you release your ego and forget the blip that you're crossing paths during currently. Like, we've found each other in this life as these two different beings, but we are one unit that has been on this journey of existence throughout time and space. Like, maybe we were bees together. Like, it feels so spiritual and so like connected to God. And for me, that's like, that's very much my relationship to love and romance. And so, and then I think I've also had that same struggle of like differentiating, like, what is a toxic codependent relationship that is seemingly born from like intense romance and connection and dedication, devotion to each other. And then like, what does a healthy version of that intense devotion look like? And I feel like, I don't know, I've just started to figure out that it's less about not, like, it's not about devoting yourself less to someone or something, but rather devoting to yourself equally. So like, even in the, under the like understanding that you and another person are one, it's like you pouring in to them would only be pouring into 50% of yourself. And also like choosing to be with people where it feels like infinity sign reciprocal devotion, you know, like, I think that's where things can get toxic, because I do think Catherine and Heathcliff's relationship is toxic because they never fully realized their connection. You know, she married someone else, he yearned for her his whole life, you know, they had their own children. And you go through the whole, at least rereading it this time, I was like, dude, this could have been avoided if y'all just like didn't give a shit, like, or if Catherine in particular didn't give a shit about class and image, you know?
I realized that when I went into Wuthering Heights, I didn't really know what it was about other than like mist, fog, angst. Even though I saw the 2011 movie with Kay Escolidario from Skins, and I like didn't get it. I at the time, I think I was just like, this is a lot of mud, and that's okay. Like you said, I was like reading this, I don't know if I like would have gotten it if I was younger, like if I would have understood it, because like I pulling out from, if you don't know what it's about Catherine and Heathcliff, who are sort of raised as siblings in this isolated English area. Heathcliff is like a foundling that Catherine's dad just brings home one day, and I didn't realize this until I was flipping through my notes earlier. Like, we genuinely know nothing about Heathcliff. We don't know where he's from. And his name actually comes from like the Earnshaws, which is Catherine's family. The Earnshaws have a dead son named Heathcliff. So they're just like, we're going to copy paste it onto this kid. And he's like loved by the father, but loathed by everyone else except Catherine, because he is like devoid of context. You know, he's just floating around. He has much lower status. And so like Catherine finds ways to be elevated in the world, and they become separated, and Heathcliff sort of spends the rest of his life trying to cause misery and pain to others, including Catherine's descendants, and is sort of literally haunted by her when she dies about halfway through the book.
After begging her to haunt him.
Yes, there's that scene. I was looking at it. It's chapter 15, guys. What a. But it's also like Catherine lets Heathcliff have it, which is fantastic. But it's like, yeah, Heathcliff is like, please don't die because you'll haunt me and you're going to hurt me and I'm going to hear these words forever. But also, please haunt me when you're gone. It's, I think like it's so they're. Catherine and Heathcliff are like more than lovers, more than siblings, more than family. Like they are, you know, two bees in a different life and cut from the same cloth. And it's all of these other things that separate them. And something that astonished me in reading it was how often they are described as childish and children and infantile, which makes sense. Like they are, they go through trauma as children. Kathy, yeah,
they're locked into to that.
Yes,
age.
Very much. And the whole time I was reading it, I kept thinking about this quote from Sharp Objects by Gillian Flynn, which is a child weaned on poison considers harm a comfort.
Yeah,
it was all I could think about the whole time. But I think I also, the biggest thing that I took from this was like, I love the character of Catherine, because we see her like course of her entire life. She is just bad and messy and mean and cruel and fun loving. And I think, like, I don't know that kids today, like, I think there's sort of a lack of like media literacy happening. Mm-hmm. And I fear that people who might read Wuthering Heights today would see it as just like, this is a bad relationship, mm-hmm. the end, mm-hmm. where you can adore characters that are sort of. I mean, Heathcliff is despicable. This is a bad person. Mm-hmm. But you can still love it and be fascinated by it. I think, like, I expected it to be a romance, which it is. I think it's also an incredible, like, character study and psychological evaluation, which I didn't expect at all.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like I agree so much with what you're saying. It's like, they're more than lovers. They're more than childhood, like, quote unquote siblings or whatever. It feels like on the note of like them having this like extremely strong spiritual mm-hmm. connection that transcends time and space, it's two traumatized adults in the 1800s trying to navigate what that looks like if they can't be together romantically. And plot mm-hmm. twist, the dude doesn't handle it that well and tries to ruin her life. And that's another mm-hmm. thought that I had reading it, was just like, you know, y'all could have just like, maybe y'all are just like extremely close friends. And like, that is the depth of your love, like you can still experience this spiritual connection in this life. It just might look different. And Heathcliff is just refuses to have that experience, so much so that he ruins her life and his own, because he's like, the relationship isn't worth it if I can't fully own you, basically. Because that's what that, you know, to marry a woman in that time, that's what it meant. But the funny thing is like, you still see that today in hetero, you know, cis relationships. I mean, any relationship, but like, I'm talking primarily in my dating experiences with straight men. There definitely is like a, if I can't have you completely, fuck off. And I think that's part of where Catherine's messiness and resentment comes from towards Heathcliff, because even though she does love him deeply, she's like, why the fuck are you doing this? Like, if you say, if you say you love me like you do, like, this is not how you treat. And so I think it's this, it's definitely a character study, particularly around toxic masculine possessiveness and like control and ownership. And like, I, as like from the woman's perspective, am like, damn, like, I wish you knew that you could express this depth of love for someone without having to own them. Man. It reminds me of, I was reading this nonfiction book earlier this year called Platonic, and it's just about navigating platonic relationships. And there's this whole chapter about like friendship intimacy. And the author goes in to talk about Abe Lincoln and his best friend and the correspondence that they had. And there's a lot of like questions of like, was he queer? Did he have, you know, a boyfriend or whatever? But she was like, let's explore this as if they were just friends, because we don't have evidence of them having sex or having like a physically romantic relationship, but shares excerpts of their letters to each other. And it's like, I count down the days until I can laugh with you once again. And it's like very, it is romantic, but it is also friendship. And when I see that, like, of course, I think it becomes more complicated when it is a hetero relationship in the 1800s. I just, I thought about that reading it, especially with a lot of the romantic old language. I was like, you guys can still have this, like, without killing each other over it, you know?
Yeah. There's, I think, a moment where I think it's like a sort of a trope in a lot of like romantic fiction or novels. And I think there's a, an element of like that I feel like almost goes without saying at this point of like, we as a society and a culture look down on romance because it is predominantly like a women's genre and written by women.
Love it. Thank you very much.
There's a moment where like Kathy is talking to Nellie, who is a, who's like a servant, who's like the housekeeper as a child, and then as she grows up. But she's talking to Nellie about possibly marrying Linton, who she ends up marrying, Edgar. And so she says that line of like, he's more myself than I am. And Nellie realizes that Heathcliff has been listening. Here it is. He had listened till he heard Catherine say it would degrade her to marry him. And then he stayed to hear no farther. And then she continues to go like, what were the use of my creation if I were, or rather, she goes, Nellie, I am Heathcliff. Like, she goes on to say how much she loves him. And it's just like, if he had stayed at the doorway for 5 seconds more, but it's the anger and the resentment. And I think so much of like, you cannot separate Heathcliff from status and from class. And I think that's such a wonderful element of it, of like, she says it would degrade me to marry Heathcliff now. So shall he never know how I love him? Yeah, it's in the same, there's not even punctuation there.
Yeah, dude. It, and it is like It is like a devastating story because it's kind of giving past lives because the movie, because like that's also another situation where you're seeing two people who are very connected and very like even seemingly romantically connected and have known each other for so long. And how do they navigate the fact that in this life they can't have what society tells them they should have because of circumstance or class or whatever. And I just think that's so profound, and like watching past lives was very like healing for me, because I'm sure everyone has had that experience of, wrong place, wrong time, or like someone
100%,
that that you like genuinely connect with or feel like a soul level bond, but for whatever reason, it's just not meant to happen in this life. And having to accept that is so hard. And I feel like Heathcliff is like the embodiment of that torment of accepting it, because he never does. He never accepts. Even in her death, he doesn't accept it. And that's like also a huge lesson, I feel like, to be learned about acceptance or forgiveness, is like, I think a lot of us live our lives thinking we'll be better off as long as there's distance from this thing or this person, whether it's by moving states or the person dies or you block them on everything or whatever. But ultimately, the feeling that you have about them is internal and actually has little to do with proximity or them, and seeing how much he suffers af even after her death and is still dissatisfied after her death. It's like, yeah, there's nothing she could have done to heal what is going on within him.
I've had things like that where it's like it is hard to get over because there's no messy breakup. There's no, it's not me, it's you. It's just like it just doesn't work. And I think like something I'm hearing from you and with the book is like some feelings never go away, and it's that we have to learn to live with them inside. And I think like if you there's simply, it is an understatement to say that Heathcliff was not set up for success. Like there this wow. But like there's
His like victim mentality of like, I was tortured my whole childhood and nobody accepted me and you were the only one. It's like, dude, go make some friends somewhere. Like, you know what I mean? Like he's definitely, I mean, because a victim mentality is rooted in a lack of acceptance of yourself,
100%.
your reality, your, what you're capable of. Like it's, and so just seeing him transform into, this kind of from this very like soft, connected childhood friend of Catherine's to like this hated, brooding, resentful, mean person, because he's unwilling to let go of the past. He's unwilling to decide, hey, my life may have sucked before, but like I'm going to have a better life now. Yeah, it's his demise and his, but there is the hope of breaking generational curses with their children, which is also probably one of my favorite aspects of the book. It's like, because if it didn't have that, damn, what a depressing.
So what you're referencing is that Heathcliff marries Kathy's sister-in-law, Isabella, purely out of spite. Specifically, because he finds out that Isabella, who's younger, is like obsessed with him because she's young, because she thinks he's this like mysterious stranger. He marries her specifically like to be brutal to her, to make her miserable. I don't know if it's said explicitly, but to say like, because you think I am good, I have to do everything to prove to you that I am not. Which I've dated that, bro. But Isabella and Heathcliff have a son who is named Linton. There is a family tree in my copy of the book, which is not helpful enough. The Wikipedia page is helpful.
Yeah, it is complicated, yeah.
A lot of repeating names. Catherine has a daughter named Kathy.
Yep.
Heathcliff arranges his son and Kathy the younger to marry. They hate each other. And then Catherine the younger ends up marrying Harriton, which is Catherine's brother's son. So there is incest. They are cousins.
Damn, I don't even think I realized that because the family tree was so confusing.
It makes exactly. It's sad that in this book you're like, it's incest, but like, it's that's not the worst thing here. Like, we'll let that happen because the rest is so bad. Yeah, it's like, just let me have this one hope because they're like, maybe they'll be stunted and albino, but like, at least they'll be happy.
Yeah, they're like, I actually don't know anything, so.
One thing that has that I like didn't really realize until, like, I think something that was like ultimately a big connection for me between the characters and the author and the book as a whole is like how setting as a character and how like deeply isolated this world is. And so the name Wuthering, first off, comes from, they say it in like the third or fourth page, is like because it is so windy, because like the landscape is so hospitable. The book is narrated from the perspective of a guy who's just like wandering through, and one of the first sentences is a perfect misanthrope's heaven to describe how fucking miserable this place is.
Yeah.
Wuthering being a significant provincial adjective descriptive of the atmospheric tumult to which its station is exposed in stormy weather. Which is also like, that's, I think like tumult and storm is also adolescence. And it makes so much sense that the extremity of the emotions in here will perfectly meet the extremity of adolescence and those feelings, 100%. But I also wanted to ask, like, you're from Texas. This is a very gloomy, rainy setting. And did that pull you to it? Was that at all a factor?
Definitely. I mean, I don't know if it's because when I was in high school, like, I just wanted to fucking live in Seattle and
Twilight was big for everyone.
That's all that I Twilight wanted. Was huge. I also, this might be like too radical, but I also saw this TikTok the other day that made so many things make sense to me. They were like, you know, this TikToker is a Black woman. She was like, you know, white people, y'all are getting skin cancer because you're supposed to be like in the woods. Like, you're supposed to be like in Ireland, like in the rain, or in like Britain in the rain and the gloom. Like, you're not supposed to be here. That is true. And that also explains why I have felt gravitated towards such climates, because
yes,
I am pale. So yeah, definitely drawn to that like energy, that setting. There's something very, yeah, setting as a character, like having this very like oppressive environment. Can, like you said earlier, it was like very muddy. You're like, there's so much mud. And I'm like, that is like, in terms of like our two characters being so fundamentally stuck in adolescence and who they are, it's like, yeah, the fucking, it's like they're stuck in the mud and the rain and the cold, and they're like stiff and shaking, and there's a reason why it is called Wuthering Heights and not like Heathcliff's Revenge, or you know, like it's called because I think the setting encapsulates the internal world of the characters as well.
Yeah, and the younger, like Catherine Jr., is like forbidden from leaving her house. Kathy, the older, talks about like feeling trapped in this place, which is interesting. It only now in thinking about it do I realize, like, Heathcliff went away for a long time, really saw the world or had the the opportunity to see the world, and said, no, I'm gonna come back to this place that has always hated me to stay here. And like, he becomes the master of it through some, yeah, there's always a gambling debt narrative, I think, in the olden times. That's the thing. I think a lot about the film Gaslight with Ingrid Bergman. And in that movie, a lot of the plot is about rare gems. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we have enough stories about rare gems anymore.
So true. So true.
Just a thought. Was the last great gem movie Titanic? I don't
Uncut
know.
Uncut gems?
I have not seen Uncut Gems because I am like, I have anxiety already. That doesn't seem fun to me.
Don't. Yeah. And it's also, it's not giving rare gems in the way that I think you want.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some line that Kathy says about, like, just feeling stuck here forever. And I think that's also very applicable to being a teen, when your world is as far as your parents will allow you to roam. And right. I think also, like, these characters, I think when you think of, like, young Kathy and young Heathcliff, they are scampering, they're running on the hills, and they're making this very dreary landscape their own and their own place.
Yeah.
Yeah, here. What were the use of my creation if I were entirely contained here?
And when you even think about that, like, what does here mean? Like, it could literally mean Wuthering Heights, but does it also mean this, like, state of being that she's stuck in? And she, like, I'm sure we've all had that moment, or at least one, you know, transformative moment in our lives where it's like, what is my life going to amount to if I keep thinking this way? If I stay in this way of living or this way of perceiving myself and the world? And Wuthering Heights is like, the setting is such a great, I think, metaphor for, like, that dark thinking and insecurity and control and resentment and all of these things that become the demise of so many people. Like, it this is not exclusive, even though it seems so, like, Victorian and like, brooding. Like, this shit is still, like, that's, and not that it's wrong to, like, stay in a hometown or anything like that, but we all have friends that have stayed, maybe not even in hometowns, but in relationships, in places, in careers that they're so unhappy with. Yeah. And because of that, they can become, like, fucking horrible to be around. And so, yeah, that passage in particular just makes me think of, like, what were the words exactly? She's like, what were I to be? What was the use of my creation if I am to be confined?
Yeah, I'm finding it again. There's another line that when she and Heathcliff really, like, are at each other's throats, that, yeah, if what were the use of my creation if I were entirely contained here? Yeah. And then, I'm tired. This is in the big scene with Heathcliff. I'm tired of being enclosed here. I'm wearying to escape into that glorious world and to be always there, not seeing it dimly through tears and yearning for it through the walls of an aching heart, but really with it and in it. And then she says, like, when I die, and because there's this sort of, the way they talk about it, and I love how Victorians talk about illness, because it's like, I don't know. So there's, like, a lot of saying that, like, Kathy kills herself and, like, cries so much she makes herself ill. But in the same sentence, you are sorry for me. Very soon that will be altered. I shall be sorry for you. I shall be incomparably beyond and above all of you.
This is a double Scorpio relationship. They're both Scorpios. I thought of another layer to that quote, beyond, like, who am I to be if I am confined here? That could also mean, like, Heathcliff's perception of her. Like,
yeah.
because she, regardless of their deep connection, which I do believe is real, she has clearly become an idea to him instead of a fully fledged human being. Otherwise, he would allow her the autonomy to live her life.
Yeah.
And so I feel like she could also be speaking to, like, I'm a full person, and to you, I remain this idea. I am confined to the idea that you have of me in your mind.
Yeah.
And you are preventing me from breaking out of that, which is so fucked up. And
Yeah.
I'm sure we've all been in relationships. I know I've certainly idealized people before and been like,
Oh yeah.
no, you need a change. And instead of me walking away from this or me accepting who you are. And so I feel like I, at any given moment, I can relate to either. With Heathcliff, like, he becomes definitely despicable. But like, for someone like, my grandparents adopted me, and it definitely was not giving Heathcliff. I was not like hated by the entire town or anything like that. But there is definitely a type of otherization that you feel like, you know, I was adopted right before I started high school. So like, I didn't have parents that were the age of everyone else's parents. And like, telling people that I live with my grandparents was like a whole, why, you know, what's going on? And, you know, there are immediate perceptions that people have of you if you have an unconventional, you know, family.
Oh, yeah.
That being said, like, the worst elements of Heathcliff is like, if you grew up with any kind of otherization, even if it's not like family related, but like you were bullied or you acted weird and people, you know, whatever, there's a resentment and a rage that is born from that experience. And a lot of us, I think particularly women, are a lot better at coping with that.
You have to be.
We have to. But that rage can still exist, or that resentment can still be accessed. And so sometimes when I was reading, you know, Heathcliff's fucking rage outbursts, which he has many, there's kind of this satisfaction of like, yeah, like I wish I could fucking be that awful for 5 minutes, you know, like, I could. I mean, I don't actually wish this, but like, it's the fantasy of the anti-hero of like, I wish I could just release my rage in the messiest and most unethical way possible.
Yeah, I think one of the things that girls learn a lot faster than boys do is that there are consequences to everything. And so like, Heathcliff can do what he wants because he is a man, and Kathy, even though she is the one with higher station and higher status, her world is much more limited because of her gender.
Yeah, even still, like, people walk away from this book being like, fuck Catherine, like, she should have married Heathcliff. Like, I mean, that's how I remember in high school, like, at least the boys talking about it in class. She's shallow, she chose the wealthy, you know, like, it's like, damn, like, she grew up in the same place, like.
Yeah, and there's even in that scene where she's talking to Nellie, where she says, like, to lower Heathcliff would be to lower my, or to marry Heathcliff would be to lower myself. She says, like, the next page after he's left is like, if I marry up, I can bring Heathcliff with me. Like, if I get higher station, I will help him. Yeah. And of course, Heathcliff doesn't hear that, and neither do the boys.
But would it matter, though? Like, I don't even think if he heard that, he would still be insulted.
Yeah, it's the same page as, what were the use of my creation? If I marry Linton, I can aid Heathcliff to rise and place him out of my brother's power. And then Nellie says, with your husband's money, Miss Catherine.
She's like, yes, bitch, like, I don't really love him. Like, damn. There's like parallels with like The Notebook.
Ooh, say more. I don't know The Notebook very well.
Oh, really? I mean, I've never read the book, but I've seen the movie. And basically, like, she and Noah, I think is his name. They have a romance in high school. They like lose their virginities to each other and like it's very romantic, but he's poor and kind of like rebellious, works like a manual labor job, and then like she moves to New York, I think, and then meets a wealthy guy and marries him. But like the whole time that she's gone, he writes a letter to her every single day and builds a house for her that's her dream house. And there's an obsession. Like he isn't the same, like grows out his hair and his beard. And he's like, I will fucking be tormented for the rest of my life. And definitely, you know, giving that like the choices and the sacrifices that we make for love versus comfort versus security, whatever.
The frustration there is like, well, I didn't ask you to build a house for me.
Right.
Like you said, like all of this is you're in love with an image rather than the reality.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what I still struggle with in my own psyche is I still want like someone to yearn for me, but I'm like, how do I do that? How does that exist in a healthy way? Because like in order to yearn, there has to be some level of like unrequited or like we can't be together, you know? And I'm like, well, I want to be with someone, but I also want to be with someone that will write me a letter every day if they had to.
Yeah. I guess it's like, where's the line between obsession and devotion?
Yeah.
Because I think like it's also like I don't want someone to be obsessed with me, but I do like the like effusiveness of, I think part of it is like obsession includes like big declarations and big shows and building a house.
Maybe it's the acceptance of the other person as a human being.
Yeah.
Like obsession is so idealistic. Like that's why it drives you to obsession. Whereas I feel like devotion kind of insinuates a level of like, I am accepting that you are this full human being with autonomy and I am devoted to you anyway. Like, there is something so beautiful about that. And I wish there were more stories that were less obsession focused and more devotion focused.
Yeah. I remember when I was in high school on Tumblr, there being discussions of like, as soon as a couple like gets together on a TV show, they stop being interesting.
Yeah.
And the only way to like maintain that is to insert conflict.
That's so true.
And I think it's like, yeah, it's because like drama and stories are propelled by conflict. And but I think that's also part of it, like in sustaining a long-term relationship, like it's hard to, you know, build a house every day for someone and that can be misconstrued. I think it's also like if you grow up as someone who feels very insecure in their place in the world, if someone is not every minute saying, look at this house I built you, you start to believe that there is no house at all.
Right.
Yeah.
You're trying to fill a void with someone else's obsession. Yeah, I think that's so, yeah, that's really, yeah, that's really true. I remember. Yeah, because like the idea of someone actually being obsessed with me, like definitely freaks me out, especially if they don't know as a person. And I think that is the difference, is like allowing a person to be a full human being and also being willing to pour your love into them despite their humanness, or because of their humanness. And then at the same time, not letting one person be your sole source of like love and adoration, like having friends that love and adore you and that you love and adore is just as powerful and meaningful as a romantic kind of love. It's not the same, but it is like, I think that's what can quickly become so toxic about romantic relationships like this, is that it just like people allow it to fully consume them because they think the consumption, like if the love is consuming them, it will also consume their pain and their trauma and their fear. It's like, eat it, take it away, consume it, shit it out. I don't want it anymore. And I just want to feel the love and no other thing. But like, there's nothing that another person can do or say that can fully deal with whatever void or like pain you're trying to. Like, I think that's maybe the, it's like love being used as a form of escape or remedy for your internal pain, instead of like turning that love inward and being like, I actually need to, like, if Heathcliff just loved himself, if Heathcliff just did his morning affirmations, he would have probably been okay. Like, there was an inner orphan in there that just needed to be like, you're worthy of love. Even if it's not from Catherine, like, you will find someone that will make you feel special and valued and whole. But I think he just thought, and I understand that pedestalization, like if you grow up isolated as a kid, like the one person that paid attention to you or the one person that adored you, like that's going to be a nearly like animalistic obsession and clinging to that, because they you do become dependent on them for your own survival, because you were never taught how to love yourself.
I think reading it is sort of like, of course all of these things happen, you know, it's so difficult, but I think it's such an interesting moment when Kathy goes away for the first time. She gets, I think, also bit by a dog and has to heal for a while at the Linton house, and then comes back, and there is this all this distance already that she's spent time with the fancy people. And he says sort of like, I don't remember actually exactly the context, but Catherine says like, as if I took notice of your lowered station. And he goes, I do take notice. Like, I notice it. I constantly am aware of this thing that you don't even have to consider.
Right.
And then there's a moment that I thought was just like, oh my gosh, such a, this is what the podcast is about. Or like, this is in talking about childhood. I think she's talking to Nellie and she says, I wish I were out of doors. I wish I were a girl again, half savage and hardy and free and laughing at injuries, not maddening under them. Why am I so changed? Yeah, that's when she's trying to like throw herself out of the window in the depths of her illness before she dies. And I just thought like, damn, I wish I were a girl again, half savage and hardy and laughing at injuries.
Yeah, that's an amazing line.
Yeah,
because she's longing for the same level of connection that was not influenced by class and society and having to live in an adult world and be in love at the same time. And I think that we all struggle with that. Like, there are lots of people who still are like, I'll never love like I loved my first love. And it's like, part of me feels like at some point that is a choice. Like, I think the reason we lose a capacity for that level of love and connection is because we decide to submit to society and shit that we don't actually care about. Like, I think we all know ultimately what we all care about the most is love and connection, but it's the world around us and the expectations around us that complicate that. And I don't think we ever lose the capacity for that, you know, first love feeling. We just don't allow ourselves to go there.
Yeah.
Either it's we've been heartbroken before and it's too scary, or our friends will think we're weird, or we'd rather invest more time and energy into our career, you know, whatever worldly thing it is. Yeah, I think that's kind of what she's maybe saying, like, I wish I didn't care. Like,
yeah,
I wish I didn't care about all these other things and I could just be running around and being in love with Heathcliff with none of this other fucking worldly shit about.
Yeah, it's like a longing to return to innocence, but innocence is also ignorance, is like not having to be aware of like there's a, as a young woman, there's I remember so clearly the day in second grade where I was sitting on the carpet ready for story time and a boy said, I can see your underwear up that dress. And it was like, great. I did not wear a dress for a decade after that. You know, there's like a moment where you become conscious of how you exist in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I also wish I could be half savage again. Maybe that's what I work on in the next few years.
I was recently back in Maryland, and I was showing it to my boyfriend, and we were there with his dad because his dad is actually from like the same area as me, which is wild. And we were driving and I was just like, look at this field. We don't have big fields in California. You can just run and yell and prance and frolic. I do. I was talking to him a couple weeks ago and I was like, I just need to be in the woods. Like, I just need to be in the woods where I can't see cars. I need to be in the woods. Yeah.
I saw this interview with Chapel Roan and they were asking her, what do you miss about not being famous? And she said frolicking.
Yeah.
She's like, I can't just like go frolic somewhere. Someone's gonna fucking see me.
Give that girl a woods. Real. It is. Ugh. I'm looking at my favorite sequence of when they're at each other's throats. And Catherine is talking, like, Catherine knows she's going to die. And she goes, I wish I could hold you till we were both dead. I shouldn't care what you suffered. I care nothing for your sufferings. Why shouldn't you suffer? I do. Will you forget me? Will you be happy when I am in the earth? Will you say 20 years hence, that's the grave of Catherine Earnshaw? I loved her long ago and was wretched to lose her, but it is past. There's... I don't know. It feels wrong to say that she's sort of like a piece of meat fought over by Edgar and Heathcliff, because she's, I think that's giving her too little credit and giving Edgar way too much credit. I think Edgar is just like, I think she's nice and not nice. I think she's beautiful and I'll let her.
Yeah. That excerpt makes me think she's like, please tell me that you're also going to destroy your life too. And not just mine. She's like, you've made my life a living hell. I'm going to haunt the fuck out of you because you don't get to like destroy my life and then live in peace after I die. And then his crazy ass is like, bring it on.
Exactly. He's like, I will make everyone suffer.
Yeah. He's like,
don't worry, my girl. Exactly. Oh my gosh. Yeah, there's a degree where she's like blaming him for her death and he's like, don't say that. You know your words are gonna haunt me forever. But also, please haunt me forever.
Yeah.
I love that it is both a love story and a ghost story, and that I think those two things are both looked down upon, and yet this book is held up, like not only held up as like still good, but like very much revered.
Dude, I can't believe like, she wrote this in her 20s. That's fucking crazy.
Absolutely wild. Yeah, I think she would have, I don't know what like when in the year she was born, but she would have been, I think, 29 when this was published.
Her Saturn return. She's like, I'm writing the best book, the only book I'll ever
exactly
write.
And then she just lay down.
Yeah. I should read a collection of her poems next.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm excited to read Jane Eyre, and I think Anne's book is Agnes Grey.
Anne might have written two books. Jane Eyre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Charlotte, the older sister. The older sister who lived. Yeah.
I didn't like Jane Eyre as much. Because it wasn't as freaky.
Yeah, I think like Charlotte got out a lot more. they legitimately and saw a lot more of the world.
Definitely.
Yeah, but I'm really excited to read Jane Eyre because I have heard, I think that book, from my understanding, really also reckons with, you have this idea of me and this is the reality of me.
Yeah.
But I haven't read it. Would love someone to do that on the podcast.
Yeah. Somebody
come
do
back.
It. This was so much fun to talk about, and can't wait for the movie with Jacob Elordi and
Margot Robbie.
Margot Robbie as Catherine.
I also just saw a commercial with the two of them in it, I think for like a car or something.
Oh, God.
I was like, what? Is this a tie-in? Yeah, I don't understand that casting.
Yeah,
I
that's fucking
don't.
crazy. But I am going to watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Invite me. We'll go see it together.
Can't wait.
Well, would you consider it required reading?
Yeah. Yeah. Required
I think
reading
so
for
too.
all Scorpio placements for sure. If you're a Scorpio, Scorpio Moon, Scorpio Venus, read this book.
Yeah. If you're a teen, if you're an English teacher, if you're existing in the month of October, if you live somewhere cold or someplace hot, is there anything you'd like to plug as we round out?
Just this podcast.
Big door prize? Oh.
Stream the big door
Thank
prize,
you.
season 1 and 2. But yeah, this has been amazing. I have nothing topical to plug right now, but thank you for having me on. I'm so glad I got to talk about this book. And yeah, I am excited to listen to other episodes coming out. And yeah, it's such a cool idea.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't wait to tell my friends all about it.
Oh, thank you.
And that's the end of the episode. Thank you so much to Olive for doing this. I love this book. I might start rereading this book very soon. I don't know. That's kind of new. I'm also eating my dinner. Sorry. It is the night of the 2024 election. This episode is coming out in less than 6 hours. We're certainly not going to know who the president is, but stay safe and, find comfort in the fact that no matter what, we're going to see less political commercials on our football. God bless America. Oh, that feels weird to say. Okay, next episode, Niles Abston joins us to do The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, what is often referred to as the first and greatest American novel. We'll talk about that. All right, if you want to support the podcast, please go to buymeacoffee.com/requiredreading. It's also plenty of support just to send this to a friend. I really appreciate it. You can find me everywhere at Erin R. Bowles. The R stands for my boyfriend's home.